IKEA has opened its doors. Some area residents have been waiting for this day for a long time, waiting in line.
We have our tent and our chairs. We've done this before. We did it in Denver. So we're all set up. We have our cooler that I'm going to go get. We're set up to stay here for a couple days.
Once the excitement and novelty fade, what will having an IKEA mean for our metro? Today we'll talk about IKEA as an economic and aesthetic force. Plus, the Huffington Post has called a local shopping mall commercial the worst ever.
Boots and pants and boots and pants.
Haircut.
New shoes.
On today's Central Standard, the director of that commercial speaks up. Stay tuned. People began lining up to be the first customers at the new IKEA in Merriam 2 days ago. IKEA offered free couches, food, and drinks, so that's part of the deal with these things. It's part of the promotion. Still, you gotta wonder who camps in a parking lot for 2 nights. I mean, it's just furniture, right?
This is kind of our first family outing of the summer, which is sad. It's the end. But hey, we're here as a family. We're going to have fun. We're going to win anything we can.
I'm here today to get one of these free couches to give to a couple, some friends of mine. They were all excited, but neither one of them could be here to do this. And I'm currently unemployed, so I said, you know, I'll go out there and do that for you. Like, I'll go hang out. I'll go get the couch for you guys. So,
my daughter and I are from KCK. Half of my friends are really jealous that I'm here. They wish they could be here, but they had stuff come up and they couldn't. The other half are like, why in the world are you camping out? I don't know. I mean, the couch is great and nice, but really it's the experience. I mean, we really didn't have anything planned for the next 2 days. Thought, hey, why not?
Since then, we've had a sweltering hot afternoon and a whole night of torrential downpours. We're talking thunder and lightning. The people who were still camped out in line an hour ago when the doors finally opened proved a fierce dedication to being among the first to enter. I'm Gina Kaufman. This morning, we're going to check in on the scene in and around the IKEA in Merriam, and we'll talk about the significance of having an IKEA in our town. What does this development signal other than the arrival of cute little bowls and nightstands? Let's start by taking a call from Joyce Smith of the Kansas City Star, who's there at the IKEA now. Hi, Joyce.
Hi, how you doing?
Great. Thanks so much for calling us.
Well, I'm sitting here on one of the couches that 40 people won this morning, and it's pretty comfortable, but a lot of people are still checking the couch out, so that's been interesting.
Describe the scene. What's going on there?
Well, it was drizzling a little bit this morning. Didn't seem to, pardon the pun, dampening any enthusiasm here. A lot of shoppers, a lot of people filling bags. They had the... all the IKEA employees were out in front to greet people when they came in. I've talked to people who have never been to IKEA before and seem a little amazed at the size and the selection. Other people that have been longtime shoppers knew exactly what they wanted and went straight for it. And I think they've already paid and got their meatballs and sitting down to rest a little bit.
Were people still in line after the storms, or did some of them give up? I mean, last night was intense.
Yeah, they moved them into kind of a garage area, and this morning they had ponchos and umbrellas and seemed to, you know, garage isn't the best place to spend the night, but they seemed to not be too upset about it. And there's a lot of enthusiasm this morning. I think people made friends in line, really interesting balloon animals, some aliens, some K-State animals and different things like that. So it's been kind of a party atmosphere this morning.
So people can invite their new friends to join them around that dining room set they've purchased?
I'm not sure that they made those kind of relationships, but you never know. So
you've written that in some cities the camping goes on not just for days but for weeks. This time around here in Merriam, the store limited pre-opening parking lot camping, allowing it for only 2 days. Do you think that some of these people would have waited weeks?
Well, they said in some markets before they had been up to a couple, 2 or 3 weeks. And in 2006, I think is when they decided, you know, it was still a construction site. So they really, that's not really conducive to doing that. So they limited it to the 48 hours. And when I was by Monday morning, there were three people in line right about 9, and then a few more join them. So it's been a pretty steady little line for me.
Even when it's not opening day, IKEA stores are somewhat known for generating traffic. So the city of Merriam has been working with the store to prepare for today's anticipated chaos. How has that been working out?
You know, I'm really amazed at how smoothly it's gone. They said they've been working on the plan for 6 months. I did drive by. They have a 63rd Street with the former Kmart. They're using that lot at 7:30 this morning. There were, I'd say, 20, 30 cars in that lot. They didn't need to be because there are still parking spaces in the garage, but they're going to shuttle them back and forth. So I've checked the line out on IKEA Way. There hasn't been any line, but there's been a steady stream of customers all morning for the last 2 hours coming in.
Over the weekend, I think everyone in Kansas City received a huge IKEA catalog in the mail. What else did the store do to encourage this buzz ahead of time?
Well, I know there are people that had shopped at the store before got to come in, I think, over the weekend and do some shopping. I haven't talked to any of those customers yet today, but I think there was some pre-shopping for their loyal fans that have shopped in other markets.
So, you know, I would wonder how small local furniture retailers would fare with the arrival of IKEA, except that there are so many other big stores already selling inexpensive furniture, like Target, World Market, Nebraska Furniture Mart. Does IKEA change the market in a way that these stores haven't already done?
Well, you know, when Nebraska Furniture Mart opened, I did see some shakeout. I don't know that you can attribute it, all of that, to having such a large competitor, but they just have to sell something that would be unique, try to, you know, up their customer service, whatever they need to do to compete. And like you said, there's not a whole lot left. The ones that do are very specialized, and that's how they can compete. When I talked to Nebraska Furniture Mart previously, they, at least publicly, they said they think IKEA will just increase the whole interest in home furniture and furnishings. So we'll see how that plays out.
Well, long term, beyond the excitement that a lot of people seem to be feeling right now, do you expect the arrival of this global furniture retailer to have an effect on the local economy, a major effect?
Well, we're already, McDonald's is going to open up the street, a new McDonald's, I believe on Monday night at 11:59 p.m. Hobby Lobby, I've got confirmation from Merriam that a Taco Bell wants to open between the Jack in the Box and the IKEA store. So we're already seeing more retailers opening in the area. Some of my real estate experts, and Steve can address this too, but I think they feel like there's only so many dollars that will go around. So if they're not shopping at one place, they're going to be shopping in another. But it'll certainly bring in more tourists to shop. I've already talked to people in other cities that wanted to know about the opening day because they're planning on bringing a group of friends to shop. And, of course, St. Louis isn't going to open for another year, I believe. So we've got some people from St. Louis coming in. So so that should generate some dollars for, you know, for restaurants, hotels, that kind of thing.
Well, thanks, Joyce. We'll let you get back to your IKEA opening day experience now.
Okay, thank you so much.
Joyce Smith is with the Kansas City Star. She's a business reporter. Now let's turn to Steve Vakrot of The Pitch. He wrote an article in the spring with the headline, IKEA. I shopped there once, and it wasn't a big deal. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
That headline's pretty funny. There seems to be a level of excitement surrounding the arrival of an IKEA in our city that I have to assume is about something more than furniture. I mean, I'm sure that people are excited about the furniture, but is there some added significance to having an IKEA?
There is, because, you know, part of the appeal for a place like IKEA, it's almost similar to what you saw before Trader Joe's came into Kansas City. It's exclusive. It's not something you can find in every city like a Target or a Walmart. And it's got a certain niche appeal to it. You know, the furniture is a different style.
Can you describe it?
Yeah, it's kind of this modular, real basic kind of simple style, but it's it's very contemporary. It's not like something you would find. It's more something like what you would find in a Target, although it's quite distinct from a Target than what, you know, some of the more expensive things you might find at, say, like a Nebraska Furniture Mart.
And it skews maybe young, would you say?
Yeah, young. It's compact. And in fact, you know, when I visited the IKEA in Denver last year, earlier this year, they kind of have these displays inside the store. I assume the Merriam one will have the same, where it'll have like a 350 square foot space and show how you can live comfortably in such a small space if you did all your shopping with IKEA.
Well, on 30 Rock, Tina Fey's character, Liz Lemon, has a boyfriend who moves to Cleveland. He asks her to move there, and she says that she'll move to Cleveland when it gets an IKEA, and then clarifies that what she means by that is never. Is there – so in addition to having the cachet as like a chic place to do your low-cost furniture shopping, does it have like a city identity component to it?
It does. I mean, in some ways, it sort of signals that, you know, a city like Kansas City, metro-wide, has the scale to support something like this. I mean, generally, you know, what IKEA looks for is, you know, a metro with at least 2 million people. And Kansas City has just a little bit more than 2 million people. And, you know, with this location, they wanted to pick an area that was easily accessible, easy to find. Joyce earlier spoke about people from St. Louis. Its location along I-35 is easy for people from, say, Wichita to come, because they anticipate that they're going to get people from outside the city. And so I didn't want to put it in an area where it would be, you know, you'd have to get off at a certain interchange or get on a different highway to reach it. Like, you know, Bannister Mall would be slightly more complicated to get to. They wanted to make it very easy for out-of-town visitors to get here.
Speaking of that location at that interchange and its sort of prominent location there in Merriam, you've been following IKEA's plans to set up shop in Kansas City for a while, since before the news was even official. And you covered a moment when the city almost lost the deal.
Yeah. So, you know, IKEA had explored Kansas City for a while before they made the announcement. And like I mentioned, Bannister Mall was one area that they looked at. The Great Mall or the Great Plains in Olathe was another area that they had considered, but it was too far south. They wanted something that was more central, so people from all over Kansas City could get, you know, independents could get there more easily than they could if they went all the way down to the Great Mall. And, you know, the IKEA had a lot of trouble trying to design a store for that site. If you look at some of the other IKEAs, they're in much more easily accessible topographical locations. This one was on this big retaining wall that they had built originally for a shopping center that was anchored by Circuit City. That never got off the ground because Circuit City went out of business during the recession. And the whole thing failed and sat empty except for the occasional Halloween outfit store.
So the retaining wall then was at issue, right?
Yeah, because it's not that big. And of course, IKEA is quite large. And then you have to plan an outlay for parking and vehicle access. But they eventually made it work. They kind of stacked things a little bit. But it was a little bit of an exercise for IKEA, because most of their stores are just about the same type of layout as you would find. This one's slightly different, but they made it work without having to tear down that expensive wall.
Why was it worth it to them to make this particular location work? I mean, obviously, it makes sense that the city of Merriam had an interest, the real estate developers had an interest, but why was IKEA so determined to make it work?
Well, I think, you know, part of it had to do with some of what we talked about earlier, which is that it's an accessible location. It's towards the center of the city, kind of an inner ring suburb. I think those were sort of the things that played into their hand a little bit and made them want to work a little harder. And of course, Merriam was ready to make a deal because they wanted to get that failed development off their hands, and they did.
A while back, there was news about IKEA hiring around 300 people locally, and there was some news about that, and that's a decent number of jobs. But how is IKEA as an employer?
Well, they're, you know, 300 jobs isn't insignificant, but it is retail. So, you know, you're going to have some jobs that pay pretty well, but that's going to be sort of the higher management type positions. Earlier this year, IKEA raised their store-wide minimum wage to $10.76 an hour. They did that in response to a few other retailers like Gap that had, you know, publicly said, we're going to increase the minimum that you can make as an employee here at an IKEA.
So peer pressure.
Yeah, that. And, you know, I think there's sort of this growing recognition that, you know, the federal minimum wage and state minimum wage is like hardly enough to live on. So I looked up last night what the living wage is for an area like Kansas City, and MIT has a calculator that's pretty credible. And they said, you know, for Wyandotte County, for one adult, $9.36 an hour constitutes a living wage, enough to support the things that you would generally need to make a relatively comfortable living. But it doesn't include things like cell phone bills and stuff like that. So, you know, the minimum wage for IKEA is, you know, about a dollar and a half over that. So, you know.
So maybe you could pay your cell phone bill.
Yeah, perhaps. I mean, if, you know, maybe if you had a pretty good family deal.
Yeah. Well, so, okay, other than jobs, what impact do you think the store might have on the lives of people in Kansas City beyond just another retail option?
Well, you know, I think in the end, you know, once the hype dies down and once everybody's had sort of a chance to see it and, you know, discover whether the furniture and the offerings and the experience there is to their taste, I think, you know, over time, it'll kind of get back to business as usual in Kansas City. You know, like Joyce mentioned earlier, there's only so much disposable income in Kansas City, and it's a city that's growing, but not as fast as other cities around it. So, you know, I think over time it'll just be another option for people to buy furniture, and it's affordable, and you know, if you're willing to put it together, which most of their stuff you have to do on your own. It'll be a regular outlet for people, but in the end, it'll be a good deal for the city of Merriam and just another retail outlet for the people in Kansas City.
As far as the city of Merriam goes, to your knowledge, did Merriam get any kind of incentives?
Yeah, so they had some existing incentives for that Circuit City deal, which they then transferred to IKEA. And, you know, not to get too far into the weeds of economic development incentives, you know, they offered a tax abatement and some tax increment financing, most of which struck me as a pretty reasonable deal considering what they're going to get. You know, this IKEA is projected to make about $82 million a year. The average IKEA, I guess, makes about $100 million a year. So this would be a little bit on the lower end, but it's going to be, you know, if it performs, you know, even on the low end, it's probably going to wash out pretty well for the city of Merriam, certainly better than the empty retail development they had before.
There have been lots of news stories in recent years about, you know, whatever exciting new business or amenity is coming to town. You mentioned Trader Joe's earlier. That was just a few years ago. Or thinking about amenities, the Sprint Center or the Power and Light District. Have these developments, any of them, changed, in your opinion, life as we know it in Kansas City?
Well, you know, it sort of depends on where you're coming from. I mean, you know, something like the Sprint Center, you know, if you're going to go to a concert or the occasional sporting event there, and you have the money to spend on something like a ticket, then yeah, it's a nice thing to have. Me personally, I've only been to Sprint Center twice when I got freebies. You know, Power and Light is something that some people like to go to and others don't. You know, so for the average resident, it just really depends on whether you want to take advantage of it. If you don't, then it's there for someone else and you go on living your life.
Are there businesses that arrive in cities and do have the potential to change those cities in deep reverberating ways that go beyond just the people who go there and frequent those places? And if so, what does that look like?
Well, I always sort of think about, you know, what kind of, you know, organizations or companies that come into a city and really in a way change the face of a town. And, you know, one thing that always comes to my mind is MD Anderson in Houston, which is probably the best cancer treatment facility in the United States. And if you're a resident of Houston, it's easy to get to. And, you know, you have that at your disposal. That's the sort of thing that to me is, and I hate to use the term, but kind of a game changer for a city. Because it's something that has real staying power besides high-paying jobs. It's something that people can take advantage of for their livelihoods.
Given your background as a real estate reporter, what questions do you have looking at the location, the demographics, the market for IKEA and all of that?
You know, the question I have is, you know, will it have an impact on other furniture retailers? My guess would be no, because it's such a specialized offering. It's not really duplicating anything other than, you know, affordable furniture. What remains to be seen is what kind of retail spinoff it's going to have around that area, because Merriam's landlocked and, you know, there's not a ton of opportunity for development around there, new development, but things could get redeveloped. That shopping center on the other side of Johnson Drive could get some improvement too.
We're going to take a quick break. When we get back, we're going to hear from a journalist who reported from inside the corporate structure of IKEA a few years back. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. Hello again. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you're listening to Central Standard. We've been talking this morning with Kansas City reporters about the new Merriam IKEA. Today is opening day. But now we're turning to Dr. Ellen Ruppel Schell. She's the author of Cheap, The High Cost of Discount Culture, and she teaches at Boston University. Hi, Ellen.
Hi.
So you've got a whole chapter in your book about IKEA. Can you tell us just briefly, as far as you know it, the IKEA story?
Oh, well, the IKEA story goes way, way back. The founder of IKEA, the gentleman who was interested in selling merchandise at low prices, he got his start with the theory of flat packing, whereby you take a table or chairs or other things, and you're able to kind of pack them down to what are essentially two dimensions. And if you're able to do that, you're able to ship that stuff, those items, fairly cheaply. And this was kind of a revelation. And as a consequence of this, a whole new way of thinking about producing furniture and bookshelves and things that we think of are three-dimensional and very bulky to pack. Because of flat packing, he was able to send these things really around the globe, developed a catalog, beautiful catalog, that they actually produced on in their headquarters there in Sweden, and deliver it globally, and they sell their merchandise all over the world.
And flat packing, was that's new with IKEA?
As far as I know, it was an original idea, yes. And that, again, you're dismantling furniture, you're producing furniture in pieces, and therefore able to ship it easily. And you rely on the customer to actually do some of the work, the famous Allen wrench that's used in IKEA, putting together IKEA furniture. And I think many of us have experienced the the joys and the challenge of putting together various products that IKEA has made.
Can you talk a little bit about the business model? You're kind of hinting at it right now, but just from an economic standpoint, what is it that makes IKEA so globally successful and so coveted in cities?
I'm not sure about the coveted word. In Sweden itself, IKEA is not considered a, you know, necessarily a high-quality product. And I think a lot of people who have used IKEA, people have kind of a love-hate relationship with it. What makes IKEA interesting as a company, and the reason I spent a good deal of time there, is because they produce their goods based on a price. They start with a price and encourage their designers and their suppliers to produce that product at that price. So rather than necessarily thinking, well, we want an item that can do this or can do that, the price is a starting point. And they're quite good at persuading suppliers to produce these things at that price. And the consequences of this I discuss in the book.
So one of the consequences you discuss is a sort of surprising sustainability-related issue, because the company does pride itself on some sustainability measures. But could you talk a little bit about the traffic issue?
Yeah, and I think we have to be careful sometimes when companies advertise their sustainability philosophies. A lot of times when they do it, they engage in sustainable practices that are relatively inexpensive for them to follow. In the case of IKEA, generally speaking, people average, I think, if I recall correctly, driving about 25 miles each way to an IKEA. They're centralized, usually somewhat, you know, some distance out of cities, but they're generally not terribly convenient. Until recently, they didn't really have a delivery option, so you had to go to the store. The stores are confusing for a lot of people. You have to sort of wander through them, go down to, in some cases, you know, go down to another area to pick up your item yourself, put it in your own car, and drive it. And if you're unhappy with it or need extra parts, you then again have to go back out and make this journey once again. So there's a bit of outsourcing in terms of energy use, because generally people go to IKEA generally in an automobile. And
you noted in the book that they're typically outside of the reach of public transportation.
Typically, and I don't want to say this is always the case, but this is often the case. And this is also the case, I don't want to just single out IKEA. This is also the case with most outlet stores, for example. Discounters, you know, for various reasons, if they want to save money on real estate and rent, and oftentimes that requires them to go quite a ways out from high dense population density areas, right? This makes sense.
It
this
does.
In the case of IKEA, that is generally the case.
Do you have a sense of how local economies respond to the arrival of IKEA? Is there an effect that you know of, or for box stores in general?
There definitely is for box stores in general. There's no question. And there's something called the Walmart effect. It doesn't just apply to Walmart. It applies to mass market discount retailers. When they come into an area, they often obviously underprice the local stores. And it's well known that they not only can put those stores out of business, but they also tend to lower the retail wage in the region that they locate. In the case of IKEA, it's a somewhat different story. The wages at IKEA are not necessarily lower than the prevailing retail wage. And, you know, they are a European country, a company, actually consolidated in Holland. People think they're a Swedish company. They're actually, their headquarters are in Sweden, but they are actually, at this point, a Dutch company.
Interesting.
But in any case, yes, little known fact. But in any case, they don't tend to drive down the wages in the region that they locate in.
When you spent time at IKEA and with the IKEA president, were there things about the business and its philosophy that surprised you?
Yes. The thing that surprised me the most, first of all, it was very difficult to get into IKEA. It took me over a year to get permission to get in. They're not
to just get behind
really,
the scenes.
Eager to have journalists there. Okay, so that was it. It took quite a long time, probably the longest it's ever taken me to be granted an interview. So they're not particularly open about about their processes, and I think the thing that surprised me again was this design to price, this idea that they really demand of their suppliers that they keep their costs very, very low. And as a consequence of this, what we think of sometimes of a company being a good neighbor, good global neighbor, IKEA, like many other companies, I felt was cutting some corners. And that kind of surprised me, because when, you know, I'm like everyone else, I think of IKEA as a very socially progressive sort of company. It turned out not as much as I thought.
Were there ways in which it is socially progressive?
They had some programs, again, in India, that they were doing some sort of charity work there, having local women in particular, for example, selling pillows that they were selling at the IKEA stores. But again, a lot of this seemed to me kind of tokenism. There wasn't a large philanthropic effort coming out of IKEA. It's an extremely profitable company. Again, it kind of surprised me. I guess I was, just like I say, like many people, had a different image of IKEA than I found was real.
In your book, Cheap, The High Cost of Discount Culture, you research a lot of different businesses that provide all kinds of goods and services at what we would consider a good deal. Are some of the things that you just outlined pretty typical across the board for these kinds of stores, or how do you think IKEA fares in the context of big discount stores?
I think that when we buy goods that are very low price, we often have to question how they became such low price goods. How much of that low price is a result of them, what we call externalities, you know, things that that are not calculated in the price, but actually we as taxpayers eventually end up having to spend, right? So whether it's pollution or very low wage workers who have to be subsidized by public funds, whenever you're looking at a very low price or discounter, it always comes into question. It doesn't mean that all bargains or sales, for example, are negative. And in fact, I talk in the book about sales and how they can be actually a very good thing, you know, a real sale in a store. But the companies or the retailers with permanent discounts, as we can all imagine, tend to squeeze their suppliers to provide them with very low-cost goods. And so how those goods are produced is always a question.
That was Ellen Ruppel Schell of Boston University. Her book is Cheap, The High Cost of Discount Culture. Steve Vakrat of The Pitch, did anything Ellen said pique your curiosity with respect to the Merriam IKEA store?
Well, I thought it was pretty interesting what she talked to about as far as the sustainability part of it, because she's right. There's going to be a lot of people who have to drive a long ways to get there. You know, if anybody coming from the Missouri side is going to have to drive a ways to arrive at that destination. And it's not serviced by ample public transportation. You know, the one I went to out in Denver was at there was a light rail line that went out there. We have nothing like that at Kansas City. We have a bus line that goes near there. So it is interesting to note how people are going to have to drive, which sort of offsets some of the sustainability measures that they have implemented. They have a giant solar roof on this Merriam location. I think it's like 92,000 square feet. But any more with a store like that, that's kind of a no-brainer because, you know, with the energy cost, if you have a efficient solar system on that building, it's almost going to pay for itself. It's just a smart move.
Interestingly, I mean, just to be fair, I wonder when we talk about sustainability and huge companies that are retailers, I mean, how sustainable can a consumer-based company really ever, you know, I mean, consumption itself is not highly sustainable.
Right. That's a good point. I mean, how much can they really do? Is it their fault that, you know, Kansas City is laid out such that it's not dense at all, and that people would have to, you know, if you were living out in Briarcliff, you have to get on the highway to go do your shopping at IKEA, or, you know, because there isn't one in Wichita or St. Louis yet, that people are going to drive out to Kansas City. I mean, it's not really their fault, but it's just the nature of a consumer economy.
Will you be going to IKEA anytime soon?
Yeah, I'm probably going to go once the lines die down. I'm not a huge fan of crowds. But, you know, for the furniture there, I've got a 2-month-old at home. And so, you know, it strikes me as logical to maybe save a few dollars on some stuff there that, you know, it's not people say it's not durable, but, you know, for a young child, it's, you don't necessarily need that always.
You got some guff for sharing some of your hesitation to jump right in and be among the first in your pitch article. How's that going? Are you being left in peace?
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, one thing I've sort of learned is if you write anything about IKEA that's not glowing, it's got such a cult-like following in this town that you'll get criticized, but that's, you know, it's the nature of the job.
Thanks for being here, Steve.
Thanks for having me.
That wraps up this morning's conversation about IKEA. Happy shopping if that's your thing. Central Standard is going to take another short break. When we come back, we'll meet the director of the local commercial that the Huffington Post surmised might be the worst mall commercial of all time. He has a few things to say, plus we'll visit Penguin Park. Don't miss it.